Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In a story on Utah Public Radio, reporter Colleen Might says mountain lions are considered the apex predator of the Mountain West. They used to be present across the entire continent, but were heavily hunted within the last 200 years. Not as common, these animals are still around Utah, and sightings are on the rise. She spoke with several experts to uncover the mysterious and misunderstood lives of these animals. And today we'll continue that conversation with Kristen Engerbertson, who recently received her PhD from the Ecology Center and Quinney College of Natural Resources at USU, and Darren DeBlois, Game Mammals Coordinator for Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. We'll revisit this conversation from March following the news.
This episode of Access Utah was first recorded in March.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In a recent story on Utah Public Radio, reporter Colleen Might says mountain lions are considered the apex predator of the Mountain West. They used to be present across the entire continent, but were heavily hunted within the last 200 years. And these days, not as common. These animals are still around in Utah, and sightings are on the rise. She spoke with several experts to uncover the mysterious and misunderstood lives of these animals. Today on the program, we continue that conversation with some of those experts. And so we welcome in Kristen Engerbertson, who recently received her PhD from Ecology Center and the Quinney College of Natural Resources at USU. Kristen, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And Darren DeBlois is Game Mammals Coordinator with the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. He's been with DWR for 25 years, graduated with bachelor's and master's from USU, and has been overseeing large carnivore and fur bearer programs since 2016. Darren DeBlois, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning.
So I want to start with Colleen's story. It's about 5 minutes-ish. It gives us kind of an overview, then we'll jump in and talk about these fascinating, mysterious animals, cougars or mountain lions. So let's hear Colleen Might's story, which aired recently on UPR.
Cougar is a very common carnivore found in the wildlife communities of the Mountain West. They are widely distributed throughout Utah. Their distribution is highly correlated with mule deer, which are their major prey resource.
David Stoner, assistant professor at the Quincy College of Natural Resources at Utah State, has been studying mountain lions and their management for nearly a decade.
They're masters of disguise. They keep a very low profile. That's part of the reason that they're still widely distributed. Many of these larger carnivores were pretty heavily persecuted during the settlement phase. There were very intense efforts to reduce or eliminate them altogether.
Historically, the eradication of mountain lions was for livestock protection, primarily for sheep producers across the state. They have been managed in Utah since the 1960s, and livestock predation for mountain lions is generally very rare. Aaron Bott, a doctoral candidate in the Wildland Resources Department at USU, works with large predators. Him and Stoner explain why we are seeing more mountain lions.
The human population is growing very quickly as more people move into Utah and more space is developed for human use. It makes the landscape more challenging for wildlife to navigate. Also, there's an increased interest in recreation and there's more cameras on the landscape.
Stoner speaks about a recent sighting that happened last month in Logan. A young and healthy female mountain lion was found and captured in a neighborhood by the USU campus. She has since been taken and released in a safer habitat.
That is a perfect example of the urban wildland interface in which you have houses right up to the national forest boundary. It's winter time. The deer migrate to lower elevation to avoid deep snows. So it is really should be no surprise that the things that eat the deer are capitalizing on the predictability of where their prey are.
Although they are the state's apex predator, these cats live extremely solitary lives, which present risks when surviving.
The mountain lion operates alone. They're not cooperative. Of the natural causes of mortality, getting killed by prey was one of the top causes of death. Hunting is extremely dangerous.
Because cougars are so cryptic and do not want to be seen, it can be difficult to know how many there are across the state. Darren DeBlois, Game Mammals Coordinator for Utah Division of Wildland Resources, was the district biologist in Cache Valley for years prior to his current position and has been working with cougars throughout his career.
We try to estimate trends based on how many mountain lions of different ages we see in the hunting harvest. So when people harvest a cougar with their hunting permits, they have to check every single one and they pull a tooth from the animal, get several other measurements.
Similar to counting rings from a tree trunk, DeBlois explains during this process they study the cross-section of a tooth from these hunted lions to estimate their age.
There are parts of the state where mountain lions are significantly impacting mule deer numbers, keeping those numbers from recovering to historic population levels. We've allowed increased hunting in some of those units to try to make sure that those deer herds could recover.
Cougars are considered game animals in Utah. The ability for hunters to remove them and the regulations surrounding harvests have recently changed.
Last year, House Bill 469 went into effect, which really liberalized the ability for people to harvest mountain lions, and we're waiting to see what those effects might be.
Cougars live transient lives and can travel very far distances, often referred to as dispersal events. One individual set a record of traveling upwards of 1,000 miles. Although events like this may occur across a cougar's range, they are not commonly detected due to the lack of reliable GPS data. Kristen Engebretson recently received her PhD from the Ecology Center and Quincy College of Natural Resources at USU. Her work involved filling several different gaps in our understanding about cougar ecology, including studying adult movement patterns, predation behaviors, and kitten survival.
One of the main objectives of my dissertation work was to estimate cougar kitten survival because we don't really know much about the period between birth and about 6 months because they're really hard to study.
Pause a little bit more. Yeah, so the neck is open for me.
That is the sound of cougar kittens recorded by Engebretson. Her research was conducted with project lead Julie Young, associate professor at the Quincy College of Natural Resources at Utah State, in a multi-year study on cougars across three sites. With the assistance of local hunters, Engebretson has been able to track down and study
49 kittens in the survival model, and we had 50 adult cougars collared across the whole study.
Engebretson and her team put special tracking collars on kittens that had a radio proximity link to the mother's GPS collar. Through the mother's collar, they were able to access information about the collared kittens' survival without recapturing them. They gathered data showing cougar mothers' behavior is highly variable, and anytime a mother leaves their kittens alone, the exposed kittens are vulnerable to a myriad of threats.
What we found is that across the board, experienced moms do have the highest kitten survival. We think that those experienced moms are older, they have more hunting experience.
Engebretson is in the process of generating a population model aiming to estimate the population growth of cougars in her three sites. These experts stress that although cougars are present in Utah, it is extremely rare to encounter one when recreating in their habitat.
Cougars are most active in the early morning or in the evening. I recommend people don't plug earbuds in and block out all the sounds around them. If you do, in the very rare occasion, come face to face with a mountain lion and it's acting aggressive, don't run. Make yourself look big, make noise. If you have kids around you, it's a good idea to pick them up.
Although cougars may generate a lot of feelings among the public, whether it's fear or amazement, the reality is they are large but cryptic mammals trying to navigate and live in an increasingly complex world. Visit the UPR website for additional information on cougars and how to safely recreate in their habitat. With Utah Public Radio, I'm Colleen Might.
In a lot of ways, they're just gigantic house cats. Behaviorally, their mannerisms are almost identical.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We just heard Colleen Might's story, recent story on UPR, about mountain lions or cougars. And a couple of the experts featured in that story are with me for the hour today. Kristen Engebretson recently received her PhD from the Ecology Center at the Quincy College of Natural Resources at USU, and Darren DeBlois, Game Mammals Coordinator with the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. So I want to ask each of you, just at the top, animals in the story here, and I think I agree, are described as mysterious and misunderstood. Darren DeBlois went first with this. The mysterious part, I guess, because the regular public doesn't see mountain lions very much. Maybe a lot of us won't even ever see one in our lifetime.
Right. Yeah. It's a difficulty to manage when you can't go out and get a count of the number of animals that they are. And so we do face some challenges there. And that's one of the things that we are studying in Utah, one of the things that we're hoping to get out of some of Kristen's research. So, but you're right, people will very rarely see a mountain lion, but probably often if they're recreating in the mountains, be close to one.
Really? So we might be close to one, but we wouldn't. So do mountain lions generally avoid humans then?
Yeah. They'll typically avoid. And, you know, some of the interesting things, and I'm sure we'll get into it, that we've seen with this GPS collaring effort is you know, when Kristen would be in working with kittens, that mom would be close by. And if you didn't know she was there based on the radio, you would never have known that she was in the neighborhood. So risk is low. I know some people get worried about the fact that we have these animals in our mountains and throughout the state, and the chances that anyone will ever have an encounter or even see one are low.
Now, we recently had a mountain lion sighting on the USU campus here. There was an alert that went out campus-wide. I guess, if there's a mountain lion around, there is some danger. That mountain lion was captured and relocated. So, Kristen Ingebrigtsen, again, just on kind of the wonder factor, you've been around mountain lions. In fact, you know, search them out and study them. What's it like? What's it like being around a mountain lion?
I think they're pretty amazing animals. I did spend the last 6 years almost studying them in the mountains there in Utah. They are, like Dave says in the story earlier, they're like big house cats. They have a lot of behaviors that kind of seem similar to if you had a pet cat, but they're just amazing, strong, quiet, secretive animals that I have a great deal of respect for. And getting to work with them, capture them, and study them, you really just appreciate them a lot more, appreciate how they're able to live in the mountains by themselves, solitary, and survive in these landscapes that have a lot of human use and a lot of other things going around. So I felt very grateful to be able to work with them and study them, but even going out and purposely looking for them, it's hard to find them. They really don't want to be around us. So I think I have a great deal of respect for them. And I also, I want other people to have that respect because they're just wonderful animals. They're really cool.
How do you find them?
So for capture, we actually partnered with local hunters who are individuals who hunt them for game, for sport, with hounds typically. So we built relationships with many hunters in the areas of our studies, and they would assist us by using their hound dogs to catch individuals that we could then dart, tranquilize, and collar.
And you work especially with kittens. We'll get into that a little bit later. Darren DeBlay, this is an apex predator. Right. Talking about management, what do they prey on?
Primarily mule deer, but Kristen also got a lot of data on some of the other things that they eat. Elk is on the menu, not nearly as often, but certainly can be, especially for larger males. Porcupines, and I think Kristen had some grouse and you know, pretty much anything they can catch and eat. But mule deer is the primary prey source, which is in Utah of large interest to people who hunt. And so as far as management goes, you know, that's really a balance that we have to think about. And we're really interested in figuring out what that dynamic is and what if any impacts do mountain lions have on mule deer numbers and vice versa. How do mule deer numbers affect mountain lion populations?
So in the story, we heard about a house bill that passed fairly recently, liberalizing, allowing for more harvesting of mountain lions. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so not this session that just ended, but last year, the House did pass a law that loosened up the requirements in order to hunt mountain lions. And so the end effect of that is that used to have a special permit that you had to get to hunt mountain lions. Now you can hunt using a regular hunting license. They also removed any kind of limit to the number that you can take every year. And so we're keeping a close eye on on how many, you know, what does that mean for mountain lion management? So far, it looks like things are pretty much on par with the way they were prior to the change in the legislation, although we do see some increased take by people who are using traps. That used to not be legal, but that was another thing that the legislature passed. And so I think probably what we're likely to see is some localized high pressure. Lions are difficult to hunt, and most of the people that are successful are using dogs like the folks we worked with to collar and study them. And if they can't access an area in the wintertime, then a lot of times those lions are really not at high risk of hunting fatality, mortality, but we'll wait and see. We're definitely going to keep an eye on and see how things shift. And I think, you know, the primary, and I mentioned it, the legislature did have concerns about mule deer numbers. We have seen with drought and with the heavy winter we had last winter, 2 years ago or year before this one, we did see quite a decline in mule deer numbers across the state from those two causes. And there was a lot of concern from conservationists and sportsmen about what was happening with mule deer numbers. And so that, I think, was the primary concern the legislature had, in addition to livestock impacts, which is also something that we have to take into account, that they do eat deer and elk, but they also eat domestic sheep fairly regularly if that's available on the landscape. And so that obviously can be a conflict between people and mountain lions.
I want to follow up on that. Livestock, wolves, that's a controversy. A debate, right, over how many, you know, how much it's impacting livestock industry. What about mountain lions? How many sheep, and is that cutting into the industry?
Yeah, I wish I had the numbers right in front of me. It's gotten better over time, but it still can be, especially local area. You know, the local sheep herder can get hit fairly hard at times, and especially if it's a female with kittens that's trying to, you know, feed all of those mouths all at once. And so typically what we do in those instances is we do have tools that producers can use to try to solve that problem. Usually they'll try and remove that lion that's doing the predation. Utah also has a compensation program so that, you know, if we can verify that it was a mountain lion that killed those sheep or lambs, the division will provide fair market value for those animals. But as you can imagine, you know, if you're a person trying to make a living off of raising sheep, it's definitely a concern and something that we work with producers and with the Department of Agriculture on fairly closely.
Kristen Ingebrigtsen, these animals are can be solitary, right? And quite mobile, travel long distances.
Right. Yes. As adults, they are solitary. The only time you'll see cougars traveling together is either while they're mating for a short time or a female with her young. And then they disperse once the young are old enough to go off on their own. Females usually stay closer to where they were raised, and the males will go farther. It's common in a lot of mammals that do dispersal events. And they can go pretty far. And then one thing that we saw was really interesting during my study is that subadult and adult females that we were collaring, even if they had already been established in an area, sometimes they made these really big movements, which was pretty surprising. And that was one of the things that Colleen commented on, where we haven't really detected these movements before, but they're pretty interesting to see when you have the GPS collars on the individuals.
Over on the Division of Wildlife Resources, there's a story of a 1,000-mile journey for one cougar.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that one wasn't from my study. That was from a study in the NEBO with DWR and with BYU. But we did have many individuals move from, like, up in the cache. I had a cat go to the Tetons. I had a cat from the cache area around Logan go to Colorado. So they make these amazing movements, and the way we usually think about them is very localized. So it kind of, you know, encourages thinking about managing at a broader scale, a broader size.
Why are they traveling? Is it to find prey?
We don't really know. So the reason they're dispersing is because they need to move into their own territories when they're young. They need to go establish their own territories where they can find prey and mates. And specifically, the males will exclude each other. So they don't want to have multiple males, you know, in the same area. So dominant males will push the younger males out. They'll have to go establish their own range somewhere. But and that behavior is pretty well understood. We've been studying that for years. But this secondary dispersal, kind of we've been calling it just in my research lab, thinking about why they're making these long distance movements. And we really don't know. So one of the things that I'm really interested in is trying to get data from different studies, from different states that have seen this, and try to figure out what is the driver behind these behaviors, because we don't see them commonly enough to really figure out what those drivers are yet.
Yeah, we, with the new technology and GPS, we, you know, these are things that were probably happening all along. We just didn't detect it with a radio caller that you have to go out with an antenna and listen to. They would just disappear and you wouldn't have any idea that this, you know, we're getting a location every 2 hours with these callers. And so we get pretty fine scale information about where they go. And that the cougar that Kristen talked about that went to the Tetons, you know, went up there, spent some time, came back and wound up, you know, when the battery on the collar died, was just north of the Utah or Idaho border, close to Nevada. So kind of that Three Corners area. And that was about 1,000 miles too, altogether, that she did over, you know, from, I think she left in the fall, didn't she, Kristen, and mm-hmm. winter, Idaho, and was in the Tetons that next sort of spring, summer, but made that movement back to close to the Utah border that summer. So she was really on the move. So yeah, it's a mystery why they do it. But one of the take homes is that, and Kristen mentioned this, is that we need to think about management probably on a larger scale. So it's good in that connectivity between habitats seems to be there, at least for these animals. And that's good for management. That means that there's genetic diversity and the capability for those animals to move if they need to. So it's different than California. California, and especially in the LA area, has some real concerns about highways and things that limit cougar movements, and you can get some genetic issues with that kind of isolation. We don't seem to have that in Utah, and probably not, you know, Utah, Idaho, Colorado ish maybe Wyoming. Those populations seem to be somewhat connected.
Well, we're overdue for a break. Let's take a break. We're talking about cougars, mountain lions, these mysterious and elusive animals. And we're talking with a couple of experts, Kristen Engebretson, who's recently received her PhD from the Ecology Center and the Quinney College of Natural Resources at Utah State University, and Darren DeBloy, Game Mammals Coordinator with the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. We'll have more following this brief break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in March.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We are talking about the mysterious and misunderstood lives of cougars, mountain lions. They were heavily hunted within the last 200 years, and the numbers are rebounding. And we're talking about cougar behavior and all things related with Kristen Engebretson, who recently received her PhD from the Ecology Center and the Quinney College of Natural Resources at USU, and Darren DeBloy, Game Mammals Coordinator for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. So, Darren DeBloy, in Colleen Might's story, you gave us some advice. I don't want to fearmonger. I don't think it's, you know, we're in high danger, any of us really, of being attacked by a mountain lion, but it does happen from time to time. Could you give us again that advice? First you said if you're, you know, jogging kind of in the interface, wildland urban interface, don't have your earbuds in, for one thing.
Yeah, I know a lot of people like to do that, and I personally, when I do that, I like to listen to music too. But if you're anywhere that mule deer are common, you're going to be in mountain lion country in Utah, and it's good to really be aware of your surroundings. As you mentioned, the chances are low. I mean, think of it, you're more likely to slip in the bathtub and hurt yourself that way than you are to be attacked by a mountain lion. But it never hurts to have a situational awareness as you're up there. Mountain lions are ambush predators. So if, you know, if they're attacking in order to try and kill and eat a person, you know, the first indication you're going to get is probably some sound movement as the animal breaks from cover to try to catch you. That's even more rare than just encounters in general. Probably everybody remembers not too long ago, I guess a couple of years ago, there was kind of a viral moment. A guy that was jogging in Utah County encountered a, it looked like, if you watch the video closely, encountered a mother cougar with kittens. And the cat kind of, this wasn't an ambush situation. She was just trying to keep him away from her kittens, and but followed him down the trail quite a ways. And he did everything right, as far as I can tell. Just, you know, made himself look big, made a lot of noise, a lot of shouting, just made himself look like something that she didn't want to mess with. And I think finally, to break off that encounter, he picked up a rock and threw it. So, you know, don't be afraid to protect yourself. Bear spray can be effective if you're spending a lot of time, you know, in those environments. It's not a bad idea to carry something like that. You don't necessarily have to have a big giant can, but that's really just that CS spray that people can get for self-defense. And just be aware, if you're with a small animal, you know, pets, children, if they're small, pick them up. Don't leave them on the ground. And again, just be willing to make a scene and discourage the animal. Don't run. Again, lions are built to chase down and catch things, and that may trigger an attack if you turn and run. So face off and try to fight back and get out of the situation.
You said anywhere mule deer are, of course, we have urban herds. I've encountered, you know, deer crossing the street in front of me, you know, on Old Main Hill at USU. Cougars, are they going to come into those environments?
They do. And again, typically they're trying to avoid people. And so, and I don't think it's anything new. We've probably had, you know, we've had mule deer in those interfaces for years and years and years. And with an advance in technology, people have got doorbell cameras and security cameras now on their properties, and they're starting to see these animals on that kind of stuff. And again, it's probably not a function of more cougars, although we do have indications there are more. It's probably just people just weren't aware that they were there until they had something to monitor them. But yeah, they will. That one on campus, the one that was in the cemetery that we moved a couple of weeks ago, was probably down there because there were deer there.
Kristen Ingebrigtsen, anything to add on that? If you encounter a cougar.
Yeah, I think Darren hit it right there, where you just want to make noise. You want to make yourself known. So I, as part of my research, went in to investigate cougar kills because we wanted to know what they were eating. And we wanted to put cameras on those kills to get behavior, to videotape their behavior. So we were going in on very fresh kills. And my rule for myself and all of my technicians who helped me with this project was, we just want to make noise. A lot of times when you're in the woods, especially if you're hunting, you want to be really quiet so you can see wildlife and enjoy it. Or you're just kind of in your own head having a nice walk. We specifically wanted to make noise because we didn't want to surprise any cats or bears or anything else. So I would sing, I would talk to myself, I'd have, you know, a podcast playing on my phone, but out loud, just because I didn't want to, you know, spook a cat and have an encounter. And my crew and I went to over 2,000 kill sites over 3.5 years. And there was very rare, just a handful of times where we actually saw a cougar that was actively there at a kill. A lot of times they would move away and you could tell by the GPS data that they'd moved away. We got to do our thing, set up our camera, and then they would come back because they really don't want to have anything to do with humans. I think part of that is learned. They do get hunted pretty heavily and they associate human voices and human sounds with danger. And they are really elusive. They want to be alone. They're solitary things and they're really risk averse. They don't want to engage in a conflict that might injure them and reduce their ability to hunt. So my advice would be, if you're out in the woods, if you're on a run or doing whatever, hiking, You can make noise. You know, we always joke about saying, oh, hey, bear, hey, bear. It's the same thing with cougars. If you make noise, if they know you're there, 99 times out of 100, they're going to move away. And you want to make sure that they have, you know, space to get away. And you won't have any, you know, conflict issues. We felt very lucky if we got to see them, but we wanted to see them at a distance where they didn't feel threatened and we didn't feel threatened. And then it was just a nice, oh, there's a, you know, cougar running away over the hill. That's fine.
Darren DeBlois, in the story, in Colleen's story, one thing that stood out to me was these animals are solitary. So I guess it makes it more dangerous if they get hurt. And that hunting is a dangerous occupation for them. That prey is one of the dangers.
Yeah, I think, and Kristen can correct me if I'm wrong, but I know at least one of her collared animals was injured and died during what we suspect was an attempt at a hunting event. I think it was it an elk, Kristen? I think that she tried to, or maybe we don't.
We don't know that, but yeah, we did find a cougar who had starved and had a broken shoulder that. With the field necropsy, we think was from being kicked by elk or deer. And I know there's been a lot of, Dave Stoner's documented that a lot in his research as well.
Yeah. So definitely from hunting and you know, if you think about what it takes for that, a 90, 80, 100 pound animal to kill a mule deer that might be twice its weight, especially if it's a male, then that's a risky situation. They're definitely equipped to fight back and motivated to fight back. It's probably actually amazing that they don't get injured more often, but certainly it can happen. And then there's also a risk from other cougars. We have documented other mountain lions killing mountain lions, you know, that are fighting for food resources, or of course males will kill kittens, similar to what lions in Africa do. If they think that, you know, some other, in order to bring females into estrus and do their own breeding, they'll kill kittens if they find kittens that aren't their own. So there's lots of motivation for lions to be solitary and secretive. And then humans, of course, as Kristen mentioned, is another part of it.
Kristen Ingerson, I want to have you tell me about your study of kittens. It's still kind of weird to me. I'm sure not to you guys, but to hear these young mountain lions described as kittens, I guess it's logical. Anyway, so you study kittens. What are you trying to find out?
Yeah, so that was part of my research. We did, we studied adults, we studied kittens. We wanted to really understand more about the ecology of cats in general. But for the kitten study, we wanted to estimate survival for individuals, because a lot of the research in the cougar world, and especially in the Western US, is focused on adult survival or survival from about 6 months to a year or older, because at that age, kittens are big enough that you can catch them and put a collar on them. And there really hasn't been a ton of data on very young kittens, both because they're elusive, they're in a den, they're hidden, they're defenseless, so mom hides them to keep them safe. So it's hard for researchers to find them. And also because we didn't really have the technology that allowed us to monitor them very closely. So we wanted to look at survival from the earliest we could get them safely to up to about 6 months to fill that knowledge gap. And then we were able to use this really interesting collar technology that linked a VHF collar from on the kitten to the GPS collar on the mom. And that allowed us to get really high resolution check-ins. Basically, the GPS collar would relay from the VHF collar, oh, this kitten is with me, they're safe. So it allowed us to get a lot of finer scale data than we would have been with typical VHF. So we could actually look at maternal behavior and how often moms were spending with their kittens as a potential source of influence on their survival rate.
What have you found so far?
So we studied kittens for about 3 summers, and this research has it's come out now. So we found that older females in general, females that had already had at least one litter, did have higher survival for their kittens. And kittens that were from young moms could also have high survival as well, but the individual mothers had different strategies with how much time they would spend with their kittens. So some females will spend a lot of time with their kittens every day and only leave for a short time to hunt. Some individuals that we are monitoring would be gone for so long that we thought the kittens were dead, and we went to go check, and nope, they were still alive. Mom was just still gone for days and days at a time. And so we were able to determine that the amount of time that mom spends with them does impact their survival as well. And we were able to also estimate kitten survival in those youngest ages, which will help us with our population modeling for management purposes.
So in Colleen's story, there's some pictures. I think that you took these pictures. And
Yes.
some of these, you're holding these kittens. They look very much like very large, house cats, kittens. In one of these pictures, I was curious. You and your colleagues have masks on. What were you doing there?
Yes, so we were conducting this study during COVID. So that was a capture that we did during 2020. And of course, no one really knew what was going on and if we could give the virus to animals. And as we know in the research now, there are white-tailed deer that have COVID. There have been some captive animals at zoos that have gotten COVID from humans. So we just wanted to exercise an abundance of caution. Since we're going in and we're catching these kittens that are really vulnerable, we didn't want to be a detrimental effect, an impact to them. So we wore masks to protect both the crew members that we were working with closely and protect those kittens.
In Colleen's story, there was some sound. I think did you gather that sound? There's some sounds that again, Dave Stoner said that very much. These are cats, right?
Yes.
They're sounding like cats.
Yeah, most of the audio in Colleen's story, and then also on the web story, there are several videos. Most of that audio and video came from my research project. There were When we're holding the kittens and we're, attaching ear tags and doing measurements, they'll make these sounds that range from a squeak to a growl to a hiss. And they sound like angry house cat kittens. And they're easier to handle when they're about 5 weeks old, which is when we wanted to catch them. As they get bigger, we caught some around 6 or 7, 8 weeks, where they get pretty fierce. They want you to know they're not house cats. They are indeed wild animals.
So during deploy, again in Colleen's story, I learn that I guess the requirement if you hunt a cougar, you need to bring him in. That's because you want to study this. You extract a tooth. What are you doing there?
Yeah, so every animal that's killed by a hunter, we want to have a chance to check in and look at. And the tooth, you can take the tip of the root and slice it and dye it and look at it under a microscope. And similar to a tree, you'll see rings for annual growth. It's a little bit more subtle in cougars because they don't have a winter of hardship typically, but you can get a good estimate of their age. And so right now, if we want to try to estimate population numbers, we really rely on the hunted animals that we see and the ages that they are when they come in. And you can back calculate a population estimate based on, if you have a 5-year-old cat, for example, 1 year, you assume that it was 4 years old and alive the year before. And you can kind of back calculate with all of those animals through time and you get a low population estimate because you're only looking at hunted animals and not all animals that might die in a given year, but you do get a trend, and that's where we're getting some of our information about what populations have done over the last decade, and it looks like things they probably peaked since settlement peaked in numbers around 2018, 2019, and we're probably seeing some leveling off or decline since then. As you mentioned at the beginning, cougars were pretty heavily hunted and treated as agricultural pests until 1967. And so they didn't ever go away, but there were much fewer of them, 55 years ago than there are certainly today.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with a brief final segment. We're talking about cougars, mountain lions, and we're talking with Darren DeBloy, Game Mammals Coordinator for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, and Kristen Engerbertson, who recently received her PhD from the Ecology Center and the Quinney College of Natural Resources at USU. We'll have more following this break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in March.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, talking about cougars and mountain lions in Utah. We just have a brief final segment here, 4 or 5 minutes is all. We're talking with Kristen Engerbertson, recently received her PhD at USU, and Darren DeBloy, Game Mammals Coordinator for Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. Let me start with Kristen here in this last segment. What don't we know? What are you fascinated to find out in the future about mountain lions?
Oh, that's a great question. There's a lot that we don't know, although we have been studying these cats across the state for decades. Many people have been doing research about these guys, but because they are so elusive, there's a lot of things that we don't know yet. One of the things that I'm really interested in working on is trying to figure out the motivations for those long distance dispersals that we talked about a little bit ago. So we see these infrequently, and trying to figure out if it's prey, if it's something, if it's human, you know, affected, if it's climate, what are they doing? Why are they doing these long distance movements? And why are only some cats doing them? And then another thing that I'm really interested in continuing to work on is looking at better ways to estimate populations. So as Darren mentioned, how we manage them currently and how we kind of estimate populations is largely based on harvest numbers to detect trends in what the population is looking like using that harvested population, those individuals who are hunted, as a sample. And I'm working on integrating the kitten data that we got, those survival rates, as well as the harvest data and survival information from the individuals that I had collared, the adult animals, and other studies throughout the area, to try to estimate population growth and population sizes in those management units a little bit more closely.
Yeah, fascinating. A lot to learn about these animals.
Definitely.
So, Darren DeBloy, what are the kind of the top couple of questions in your mind as you look at managing these animals? What keeps you up at night about cougars?
I think the things that keep me up at night are just making sure that we don't have any kind of serious conflicts with people that involve an injury or a mortality, or, you know, a person getting killed. But those, although very rare, is something that concerns me. We want to make sure that people understand, you know, how to keep themselves safe. But the kind of the holy grail of management would be that population estimate, to kind of really get a good idea of how many of these critters we've got on the landscape. And then the other management question is just interaction with prey. And so, you know, particularly with mule deer, how are mountain lions affecting that prey base, and vice versa? And, you know, we have some early data. We've got a lot of these same global positioning satellite collars on mule deer in the state, and we're starting to see some correlation in some areas where, you know, if deer get too heavily hunted by mountain lions, it can affect overall population numbers. And so those are two things that we're really looking at closely still.
All right, a good place to end the conversation, and you can find out more at Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. Wildlife.utah.gov is a place to go. What would you suggest, Kristen, to find out more on your studies and those others at Quinney College?
Yeah, several of the papers from my research have come out, and we try to share those. We want to make sure that information gets into the hands of citizens who are interested. People can also reach out to myself or my advisor, Julie Young, at at Utah State for, you know, any additional questions you may have.
Okay, very good. And you can hear Colleen Mite's story we began the program with at upr.org. Of course, Access Utah will be up on upr.org as well. Thank you for the conversation. Fascinating. Kristen Ingebrigtsen recently received her PhD from the Ecology Center in the Quinney College of Natural Resources at USU. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tom. This has been great.
Thank you. Darren DeBlois, Game Mammals Coordinator for Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, has been with us as well. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks.
Skywatcher Leo T here as we look up, look around, and get a little bit lost in space. Did you happen to check out the new meteor event? I did a few times, and although I only saw one, it was pretty neat. Arcing across the sky below the handle of the Big Dipper, a green streak. The Tau Herculid shower did not produce a huge output, but any time I'm looking in the southwest and seeing vibrating Antares, the orange-red giant just above the horizon like a warm fire crackling, and the trails of stars that make up Scorpio, and further north, east above the mountains, blue-white Vega, giving signs of sparkling hope, and the star trails between these and the Big Dipper, I'm glad I came out to look. Then on the west side of the sky, the twins Castor and Pollux with large Capella lower to the right, and the fingernail crescent moon jumping up in the orange sunset above Antelope Island or the Moab Rim. It makes an animal here on Earth happy to be part of all this somehow, and the shooting stars, the ones that came from a new meteor shower, lit up the night sky in a rare display overnight Monday and Tuesday. As remnants from a shattered comet blazed through the Earth's atmosphere, and the Earth clearly crossed a cloud of dust from the comet. Photos on the Skywatcher Facebook page, along with sources for this episode. And scientists stumbled on a new way to study stars by taking advantage of meteorological satellites orbiting Earth. New data from a Japanese weather satellite that happened to observe red supergiant Betelgeuse during a period of interesting dimming, leading to astronomers thinking she was going to blow up in supernova very soon. Scientists still think that within the next 100 years, the big star will do just that. As many cultures, one sky. Continuing this week with exploration in South America as we descend from the Andean highlands into the rainforested Amazon. The theme of sacred water persists as members of the Barasana tribe, who hunt, fish, and gather in the northwest Amazon basin, tell outsiders that they live at the center of the world. They've got good reason to, since they reside on the equator and see the stars moving along vertical paths on either side of the east-west line, observing the sun passing straight overhead on the first days of spring and fall. They call the stars the universe people, Unmari Masa. The most important universe people live along the Milky Way or the star path. The Pleiades, or Star Thing, we call them the Seven Sisters sometimes, is the woman shaman. When the Star Thing appears in November, she heralds the end of the rains and planting time. When the residents of the Milky Way light up the night sky at dusk in mid-November, Barasana men and women, children, sit in family groups outside their cluster of huts and gaze at the Milky Way. But they're not content to watch passively. The Barasana begin to dance to the Milky Way to urge the stars along in their courses. They form two lines of ten and dance in orbits around the center of the world, replicating the motion of the stars. They continue all night long, or having a little bit of fun, at least until the stars begin to fade from view in the morning twilight. So join the Barasana and dance to the glow and music of the Milky Way. Skywatcher Leo T.